You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which presents this Aloud series free here at Central Library, and we're delighted to welcome you here tonight for a program with Danielle Allen and Franklin Leonard titled American Inferno, How My Cousin Became a South Central Statistic. We're very honored to welcome our two speakers tonight, and I also want to especially welcome members of Danielle's extended family who are here tonight from various places in the city, the county, the country. So thank you for coming here tonight. Danielle Allen, a decorated scholar and Harvard professor, is the author of a fiercely poignant and personal memoir called Cuz, on the life and times of Michael A. I was really deeply touched by this book, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Her book is a story about one vulnerable young man. It's about a family. It's a story about our country, and it's a story about our city in the grip of what Allen refers to as, quote, the parastate, a system fundamentally at war with the legally recognized state. It's an alternative universe of law and order, a union of the global narcotics business and American street gangs, which joined forces in the late 1960s and 70s. And it was in that parastate, she writes, quote, unbeknownst to the adults around him, that her cousin, Michael Allen, grew up. And September 17th, 1995, the date when he committed his crime and attempted carjacking, was a particularly inauspicious date, as California had just 18 months earlier passed the infamous three strikes law. Danielle visited her younger cousin Michael over the years he was incarcerated, and she was the cousin on duty when Michael was released from prison 11 years later. 3 years after his release, Michael was shot and killed. Danielle's memoir seeks to understand what happened to Michael and why, and also makes an urgent case for a system-wide reform of our criminal justice system. Cuz is a compassionate retelling of an objectively tragic story. It's about a talented and likable young man who grew up in dangerous social and economic circumstances, yet he was very much a young man with dreams and drive and charm. The New York Times notes, quote, among the most valuable contributions Allen makes is forcing us to ask, to what end are we locking up our children? And it's a question we'll hear more about tonight. Danielle Allen grew up in Claremont, California. She went on to attend Princeton. She is currently the James Conant Bryant University Professor at Harvard, as well as the director of Harvard Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. She's published broadly in democracy theory, political sociology, and the history of political thought. And she's the author of Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in defense of equality. And we're very honored to have her with us tonight with Franklin Leonard. Franklin is a film executive, perhaps best known for founding The Blacklist, a yearly publication that draws attention to worthy unproduced screenplays, featuring Hollywood's most popular unproduced screenplays. He's a graduate of Harvard, is currently an advisor to BoomGen Studios, and serves on the board of directors for Young Storytellers. After the conversation and your questions, we'll have a book signing in the lobby, and books are for sale tonight, courtesy of our library store. Please join me in welcoming Danielle Allen and Franklin Leonard. Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Good evening, everyone. And thank you for that amazing introduction. You know, Danielle has a decent resume, and she wrote a book that brought me to tears relatively quickly. So where I'd love to start is sort of at the beginning of your and Michael's lives, and I'm very curious to hear you describe what you do in the book. Tell me about what your sort of upbringing was like, and then what Michael's upbringing was like, and then sort of where they came together. I think that it's it was a dynamic that I recognized from my own life.
Yeah. Cousins. I mean, cousins is that special relationship, and some of my cousins are here, so they know what I'm talking about. And I'm so grateful to them for being here, and other family members too. Thank you. And thank you, Louise, wherever you went to, for this wonderful invitation. So I grew up in Claremont, California, college town. So I am a faculty brat. I'm the kind of kid who went to school when I was 4, and I never left, basically. And my parents made a decision when my brother and I were really little that they weren't going to move till we turned 18. Regardless of what opportunities came my father's way, they were going to stay in one place. And my mom, who's here, is a librarian, so there were lots of books in this bookish town. So it was just sort of books and stability. My dad was from a big extended family, group of 12 siblings, and a lot of those siblings were here in Los Angeles. So we lived in Claremont, but we were part of the Allens in Southern California, and we got together for holidays. We got together for other occasions. I used to go to one of my aunt's houses to get my hair relaxed on a monthly basis. So there were these like other ways of being in each other's lives. And my dad's baby sister is Karen, and she had 3 kids, Nicholas, who's here tonight, and then her baby, Michael. And Michael's this beautiful kid. I mean, in the book, I talk a lot about his gorgeous smile, sort of all toothy, big grin, incredibly curious, active, loved to be outdoors. He was a motor mouth. He always felt like he had so much he was excited about. It was hard for him to get it all out. He was just sort of so talkative. And Karen was a single mom. She left their dad, who was abusive, and moved from Florida to Los Angeles, and then inched her way forward. I mean, she is honestly one of the hardest working people I have ever known. Just day after day, working to hold it together, working her way through nursing school, working her way up in the health industry, and so forth. So, the life of a single mom is just plain not easy. There is never enough time or enough money to put all the pieces together, regardless of how much dedication a person brings to the work and the effort. So Karen and Nicholas and my cousin Rosalyn and Michael were in our lives a lot. You know, sometimes we were in their house, sometimes they were in our house. And again, like holidays were a lot of togetherness. But as kids, we were like a group of me and my brother, and then these 3 cousins sort of just tumbling about Southern California in various ways. So, you know, we felt like we were pod, 5 P's, 18 months, you know, between each one of us. And just, we had a lot of fun.
And, but Michael's sort of family situation, I mean, he moved around quite a bit. There was a stretch in Louisiana, if I remember correctly.
Mississippi, Georgia, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so maybe can I just read a tiny little passage?
By all means, please.
I said sort of Karen inched her way up, and she managed to get her and her kids into a little house in Highland Park where they were for 5 years. And those were, I think, I feel hesitant talking about this in front of Nicholas. You know, Nicholas can have to correct me. We talked while I was working on the book and so forth, but those were 5 years that were good years. And then I can say something about what happened after those 5 years. So this was from when Michael was 5 to 10. In Highland Park, the rites of passage proceeded according to plan. Michael's beautiful kindergarten teacher, the one with the blonde afro, loved him. He graduated in high style in a white cap and gown. He had gymnastics lessons and played Little League and went to summer camp. To raise the funds for camp, he sold peanuts. So successfully, even, that he funded his brother and sister's trips to camp, too. The trio would go for 3-week stints in the summer, and they would come home, their mother would do their laundry, and then she would send them off again. They always went together. Michael also had a glorious bicycle, a He-Man bike that he loved, and their house was on top of a hill. He would fly down it barefoot, not yet able to brake, ending up at least once with a swollen eye, with the bike all bent out of shape, having terrified his sister, cousins, mother, anyone who was around. His sister, who was growing into a large-bodied girl and had already developed a mothering instinct, would cry out, "Michael, why don't you put no shoes on?" We visited them often at this house, once a month from 6th to 8th grade, I would go by so Big Roz, another aunt, and her girlfriend could relax my hair. The only slightly unusual ritual in Michael's life at the time was aletots. Since he couldn't have remembered his mother's drinking, his enrollment in the program must have seemed mysterious. Karen's spirit lightens when she talks about their time in Highland Park and how amusing it was to eavesdrop on the kids' Saturday morning aletot meetings. The trio would gather outside her bedroom door, whispering up a cloud of buzzing bees. They were whispering out their grievances, which, she presumed, were mainly about her. They were a united front, and in this small house, all four of them had 5 years they are glad to remember. So you ask sort of what happened, and the short of it is, they were in Highland Park, and Karen met and fell in love with somebody and got married, and, you know, in the world of the late 80s, early 90s, this is sort of a single mother's dream, fall in love, get married, get out of being a single mother, and so forth, but the person she married turned out to be violently abusive, and their lives just exploded. And over a period of 5 years, they moved from California to Mississippi to Georgia, back to California. And so Michael had 5 school transitions, all mid-year transitions in that period. And the last phase of the move was from a stint in Claremont into South Central Los Angeles. So that's where he had landed in the year before he was arrested for the first time on the attempted carjacking.
Yeah, can you walk us through the crime, for lack of a better term?
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, this is one of the things I say about writing this book is, I mean, nobody wants to stand up on a stage and say, I'm here to talk about my cousin, the attempted carjacker, okay? Like, that's not a fun thing for anybody to do. And so it's important to recognize that to talk about a story like this and to try to tell it and be honest about it requires breaking through a lot of shame. And I think working on this project has been hard because it meant my family, which had never talked about what happened to Michael, we all had to kind of break through that ice about not wanting to talk about what had happened in order to see, to get the answers to the why questions, like because of this, because of that, because of this, because of that. So as far as the crime is concerned, the short of it is Michael did not have any history of violence. If you know, I've talked to so many family members to just, you know, just check and to learn about Michael and learn pieces of his story that I didn't know. And if you ask the question, do you ever see Michael be violent? The answer is no. So there's his mom saw him be violent at the end of his life once in a fight, knocking somebody out. But in childhood, before this incident, literally you cannot find a case. And what seems to have happened is he landed in South Central, as I said, as a, you know, kind of an atom, isolated, not part of a community, not from any neighborhood, not from any hood. And in that landscape, had to figure out his own methods of self-protection, the complicated world of gangs. And he seems to have been flirting with both Bloods and Crips, though.
This is 94, which is like...
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So it's like the height of gang violence, the height of gang homicides and so forth. And different family members had little pieces of information about what Michael was up to, but nobody had the whole story, and we didn't put the whole story together. And the short of it is just basically, actually it started here, a sort of slightly eerie place to be. He had a day off of school in September, just like now, and his mother worked a few blocks away from the library at a place called Homeless Health Care. And so she brought him to work with her, and then brought him to the library to spend the day here while she was at work, and told him to meet her here at the end of the day. And she came for him, and he wasn't here. And then the next time she saw him, he was handcuffed to a hospital bed because he had... The only good news about the attempted carjacking is that the only person who got hurt was Michael.
Right, which is sort of the profound irony of the entire situation, at least reading it.
Yeah, I mean, so his victim reported that Michael had held his gun pointed at the ground for the entirety of the incident. His victim got the gun and shot him through the neck. And in the hospital, in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, Michael also confessed to having robbed 3 people the previous day and somebody a week earlier. So it was a spree, without any question. You have to just be forthright and say that. But it came out of nowhere. And luckily, he was the only person who got physically hurt in this. And just to conclude, I mean, what seems to have been happening is he does seem to have been taking the next step with regard to gang affiliation. And this was that moment. But the criminal justice system didn't see him as a salvageable person,
right.
Which he was.
I want to talk about that. I mean, for everyone's benefit, how old was he when this happened?
So he was 15 when this happened. And again, I was, you know, so other things that are important are not only had, so, okay, the three strikes law had just been passed 18 months earlier. And what that meant was, so because he confessed to these other incidents as well, that he had two felony charges for the attempted carjacking. People often don't realize you can get more than one felony in a single incident. So he had it was a felony for having asked for the watch and the wallet of his victim, and it was a felony for having asked for the car. So it was two felonies, and then he had two more felonies from the robberies he'd confessed to. So he was told if he went to trial and he confessed to all these charges and were convicted on them, he would get 25 years to life based on the three strikes rule. And the other thing that happened was that the laws had changed. So California had been routinely lowering the age at which somebody could be tried as an adult for specific crimes. So it had come down to 16 and then 14. So just in the months before he was arrested, it had come down to 14 for a select list of crimes, including carjacking. So he was being tried as an adult. It was going to be 25 years to life if he went to trial. So he took a plea deal and ended up with 12 years and 8 months.
And two of those charges were charges that he confessed to that the police weren't even sure, like they didn't have a record of the crimes, at least one of them?
Well, aside from the carjacking, he confessed to four robberies. They didn't have a record of two of them. They didn't charge him with those two. They had two robberies that they thought his confessions matched to. So as it happens in the records, the victims did not ID him in lineups, so who knows? But he confessed to things, and I think that's, you know, I do believe his confession in the sense that you know, he didn't at any point try to hide who he was or what he had been doing in those last few weeks. And there are other things like that about Michael in that moment that showed him to be the young person, the still developing young person that he was. I mean, you know, he wasn't ready to hold and use a gun on somebody.
Right.
Like, that's what it means if you're pointing the gun at the ground.
And then someone takes the gun from you.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And similarly, his mother wanted to bail him out, and he asked her not to. So he didn't want to be back out on the streets. And that, too, for me is sort of like, you know, I didn't know that at the time. It's one of those things you look at retrospectively, you're like, this was a kid asking for safety, asking for protection, and asking for help. And the structures that we have in place, that we had in place at the time, like, didn't see that, didn't register that, didn't offer him the help that he could have benefited from and was, I believe, ready for.
And instead, he did, so he did the 3 years as a juvenile.
Well, 2 years as a juvenile. So basically, when he was sentenced, the judge who sentenced him wrote to the correctional offices and recommended that he be kept in juvenile till he was 25, which was the maximum age he could stay in juvenile in California at the time. But instead, for reasons that are completely inaccessible, he was transferred at 17 to an adult prison. So I want to just say one word about the fact that it's impossible to figure out why. Like, that's one of those why questions I couldn't answer. Like, why was he transferred to the adult facility, especially when the judge had made this recommendation? So it's important, too, that people know. So, you know, Michael was a juvenile, which means that his record was perfectly confidential, okay? And so when he was a kid, before he turned 18, his mother and his lawyer had a legal right to access the file. But once he turned 18, only Michael had that legal right. And so then when he died, like literally nobody in the world has a legal right to access Michael's files. Okay? And whereas like most California court files are open in the archives and so forth, not for juveniles. But since Michael was dead, he couldn't ask for it himself. So I'm so grateful to Josh Malone, who's here this evening, who's a lawyer who helped me do the state-level equivalent of Freedom of Information Act requests to get as many of Michael's court papers as we could. But I never got anything that explained what this transfer to an adult prison at 17 was about. I couldn't get it.
And how frequently were you visiting him at this point?
Excuse me. So I was in graduate school. I mean, this is back to your point about like, diverging lives, right? So I was in graduate school in Cambridge, England. Beautiful Cambridge. I got to Cambridge in 1993, it's this lovely little kind of English country town along a river with these beautiful Gothic, you know, chapels.
Are you doing like a graduate classics degree at this point?
I'm doing graduate classics degree. My first thought when I get to Cambridge and I see these like beautiful Gothic chapels, I was like, wow, this looks just like Disneyland.
Right?
Like that's my like point of reference. Okay, so that's where I was. I was like English for real Disneyland. Studying poetry and ancient Greek history on the banks of the Cam when Michael got arrested. So my own journey through the academy had me landing in Chicago, at the University of Chicago in 1998, and that's when I reconnected on the phone with Michael, was after that.
And what was that? What was that experience like?
Well, you know, my first husband is here, and stepson, who spent a lot of time talking on the phone to Michael also. So I think other people can answer that question, too. Sorry.
Yeah, can we get a handkerchief for you?
But, you know, I'm sure other people here know the answer, too. It's sort of, you know, will you accept a call from the California Corrections Department? And you say, yes, of course, you know. And every few minutes you get that reminder, this is a call from the California System of Corrections.
Right.
And the experience of the calls is you're just desperate to hear the voice of the person that you love. Because you have to learn so much about what's going on from them just from their voice. Because everything, thank you. You know, obviously surveyed and watched, listened to. So there's not a lot of room for a frank conversation about what a person's going through. You just have to register from the tones of their voice. So, you know, we talked about this and that, and eventually we started working on college courses for Michael. So we spent a lot of time talking about his writing and his courses. And Bob did really amazing things for Michael on the phone. Sorry.
You most definitely do not need to apologize.
So I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did. I want to go back to this idea that you sort of can't have these direct conversations with
right.
someone in prison. And I have my own experience with that.
Yeah.
So you talk around a lot of things. Let's just jump to the Chaucer bit, because
yeah.
I thought that was actually really remarkable. As part of these college courses, Michael is studying Canterbury Tales
right.
and basically sends you an essay about Miller's Tale?
It's a mixture of the Knight's Tale and
Knight's
Miller's
Tale.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, you realize that he is communicating to you as directly as he can about a relationship
That's
in
right.
prison.
Yeah.
And I can you just tell that story and maybe just read a passage from it? Because I think it's...
Yeah.
It's not something one expects from a sort of a prison story.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think I'll read a little bit. It'll be a little bit longer this time, if you don't mind. So if you'll just go with me. Thank you. I haven't actually read this part out loud before.
It's
so
a really
nice
remarkable beat. Maybe we should set it up. I don't know that I've set it up
sure.
as well as possible.
Okay, well, so Michael fell in love while he was in prison. He fell in love with a fellow incarcerated person, a fellow inmate, transgender woman, who in the book I call Bree. I've changed her name. And he called to tell me he'd met somebody. And I remember, you know, he called, so you asked about what prison calls were like, and he said, I've met someone, Danielle. She's beautiful. I was like, what? it does not compute.
Right.
It does not compute. And I'm thinking in my head, like, is it one of the guards? Because there were women guards in the prison when I would go and visit. Like, is it one of the guards? Like, finally, we was just, again, like, talking around. Like, I got it, that it was one of his fellow incarcerated people, fellow inmate, and Bree, as I call her, dressed as a woman, was in the process of transitioning and so forth. And he sent me one of her annual prison photos, and she was beautiful. She was beautiful. In fact, here we go. Soon enough, he sent me Bree's annual prison shot. She was posed as a woman, lying on the floor like a sports pinup, made up and in colorful clothing. Bree was beautiful, or at least in that territory, and certainly ready to compete with his pretty girl and Jack Jack. These are women from a prison chat site who sought to turn their prison visiting room into the site of hot dates. I don't have that picture anymore, but I do have Michael's words describing, I think, the impression that Bree made on him. He shared the experience in the form of an essay that he had just written about the Knight's Tale and the Miller's Tale from Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. He called his essay Two Tales and Four Desires. In the Knight's Tale, two cousins of royal blood have both been imprisoned for life in a tower. Prison, Harvard. One of them, Palamon, glimpses a lady, Emily, walking in the garden near the prison. Desire immediately sets in, Michael wrote, and added, quoting Chaucer, and Palamon wants Emily. He cries out in pain. He blenched and gave a cry as though he had been stabbed and to the heart. Like me, the cousin in the knight's tale, Arcite, thinks Palamon's distress is caused by his imprisonment and chides him to endure. But Palamon tells Arcite, quoting Michael again, that prison has nothing to do with his distress, but it is from a lady that he sees wandering in a garden below the tower. Arcite looks out the window, and he is also hurt by her beauty. Michael continued and concluded, desire is powerful, and it creates a lot of other emotions. It makes men do things that they probably would not normally do. He expressed his core point this way. In both tales, the Knight's Tale and the Miller's Tale, we could not predict the decisions that men filled by longing and desire would make, nor could we correctly guess the outcome of their decisions. Michael spoke oracular words. He prophesied. He knew, without knowing that he knew it, the course his life would take. Bree is the person who killed him, ultimately. I was oblivious. I thought the essay was about Chaucer. No one could have guessed the final outcome of Michael's life because none of us took into account his most dizzying desire. Thanks.
Yeah. So I want to talk briefly about the rest of his time behind bars because he built towards a very rich life.
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff about the California, the largest fire in California history, yeah. and him being on the front lines of that, read like any screenplay that I've ever read. Okay. In terms of, like, it felt like an action movie.
Right.
And he was there on the front lines. Can you can you tell a little bit more about that? I mean, I've told a little bit, but
sure.
you can do it better than I can because I know this because I've read the book.
So, yes, I mean, this is, I described Michael as this just, you know, bright, energetic, curious, lively, talented kid who loved being outdoors. He loved climbing trees, just being outside. He used to, like, climb up on rooftops to meditate and things like that. And probably the best thing that happened for him in prison was getting the chance to be part of the California forestry inmate firefighting teams, firefighting camps. And those teams have gotten a lot more attention lately. There was a New York Times Magazine article recently about women firefighters. And Michael fought in what's known as the California fire siege. I don't know how many of you remember, but these were the fires from 2003 that, like, you know, they were above San Diego, massive fires. Out through Riverside, they are still the largest wildfires in California history. And Michael was a part of the crews that helped get those under control. And it was just an amazing period of his life. And so he was fighting fires and taking these college courses. And the college courses were something he had to kind of take multiple runs at before it worked. And it really came together at this point when he was also fighting fires. And that's where, for me, like, that was a real kind of aha moment working on this book in terms of understanding Michael. Mm-hmm. Like, he needed that balance between being outside and the physical activity and the academic activity. He needed those two things to go together. And there, you know, he wrote these beautiful letters. And in one of his letters from that period, you know, he said, like, it used to feel like I had a mountain of time to climb, and now the days are just flying by. And, you know, to realize, like, he actually had a good year. Like, even in prison, he had a good year. I can say that with conviction. And that's not to say that I'm excusing prison and what it does to people and the way it brutalizes people, not at all. But just to point to, like, even in these conditions, the human spirit can be resilient and can find a way to preserve its humanity and keep itself going. And he did have that for that brief period of time.
So talk to me about being cousin on duty.
So, yes. So, you know, a lot of us spent a lot of time as Michael was preparing to get out, trying to sort of talk about his future and where he'd go. And Bob and I had volunteered to have him move to Chicago with us and go to college with us there. And we had other family in Riverside County who were open to have him live there and keep on with the firefighting work and so forth. But then we learned, you know, in just literally like the year before he was coming up for parole, that you have to be paroled to the county where your offense is committed. And so these other possibilities were not viable.
Yes, I just want to, for emphasis sake, you cannot take advantage of a support system that you have if it is not in the county of the crime that you committed.
Right. I mean, at this point, I do believe California has started to soften some of those requirements and now has more flexibility around that. But when he got out, California did not. And so, correct, even if you had a support system outside of the relevant county, that was not something that you could take advantage of. And so we did our best to substitute. I tend to quote Donald Rumsfeld here, where he's like, you know, when he was talking about Iraq, you know, and he's like, people were complaining about the military. So you go to battle with the army that you have.
Right.
It's like, that's how we felt. Okay, we were going to go to battle with the resources that we had, which meant trying to figure out how in L.A. County to make this life work and work with Michael to do that. So he wanted to keep fighting fires. L.A. Valley Community College has a fire technology program. So the notion was to get enrolled there and try to get a job near there and get housing near there. So he got out and, you know, we did, we had our sort of to-do list. I mentioned, I think my mom's a librarian, so the first thing we do is get a library card, okay? LA Public Library, we always start with the libraries. Library card, driver's license, learning how to use computers, because he hadn't had exposure to computers before he went in, because like 95 to 2006, you know, like Google didn't exist when he went into prison.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big gap in technology.
It's huge.
Like 95, I got my first email address.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
Literally, and by 2006,
Facebook exists.
Where like the iPhone is on the immediate horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Like the world has changed dramatically.
Exactly. So we're sort of like figuring out all those things, and then working on job applications, trying to get job interviews, and so forth. And you know, miraculous result. I mean, Michael gets two job offers within a month of being out of prison, which is astounding. And you know, that there's that moment where you feel like you want to start hoping and you shouldn't. Like, it's dangerous. You shouldn't start hoping, like, even at that kind of point. But he takes a job at Sears, and he gets enrolled in the program at LA Valley Community College. And so then we're trying to lay in the third piece, the housing piece. Yeah. And this is the moment where, again, retrospectively, I can see is, like, the turning point moment. I found this perfect little tiny kind of converted garage behind a house near LA Valley Community College. And the two women are landladies and so generous. And they talk to Michael and he explains why he'd been in prison for so long and what he's trying to do with his second chance. And they give him a second chance. They're willing to rent this place to him, which is just an act of generosity and grace for which I will be forever grateful. And let it, you know, be an example to all of us. I mean, really, that they could do that, I continue to be so astounded by. But so I had a great conversation. It was towards the end of the day. And Michael says he'll take the apartment, and so I'm gonna, you know, pay the deposit and guarantee his rent. It's too late to go get a cashier's check at that point in the day. So the notion is we're gonna come back tomorrow to pay the first rent. And I drop Michael off at his mom's house, and he calls later that night and says he doesn't want the apartment after all. I'm like, what? And I say, we sleep on it, okay? We'll talk about it in the morning. So we talk in the morning. He says he does want it. And then all day long, he goes back and forth. I do want it. I don't want it. I do want it. I don't want it. And at the end of the day, he calls, and he's very decisive. And he says, I've decided I don't want the apartment. I can't imagine what it would be like if I brought my associates there. And I was like, I didn't understand. And I didn't ask questions because he seemed to be insisting on his privacy. So at any rate, a few months later, it became clear that he and Bree wanted to move in together. And that's what he meant when he said he couldn't imagine bringing his associates there. And I was like, that day, he was choosing, do I reconnect with the love of my life, Bree, whom he'd fallen in love with in prison, or do I break my connections with the people who helped me survive prison? Right? Like that's, and like, wow, that's the choice. When people are reentering, that's the choice we're asking them to make. To give up the relationships that have helped them survive an incredibly brutal circumstance in order to have a genuine chance of succeeding in a new world.
And I think probably especially difficult because Michael entered prison at 15 years old.
Yeah.
All of the major sort of life maturation moments, falling in love for the first time, surviving in a men's prison at 17 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the things that would define you certainly by the time you're in your mid-20s, which is what he was when he got out.
Yeah, 26.
He's basically being asked to walk away from everything he knew for the possibility of a life that was not guaranteed.
Yeah. I'm just going to read you one other little bit here. So one of the things I do try to do in the book is just ask us all to put our minds back. So, for example, chapter starts, "Where were you when you were 15? Close your eyes and try to recall. I lived in a bedroom with a brass bed with a blue and white striped Laura Ashley comforter. There were matching valances on my window, and I had a wooden roll-top desk with a drawer that locked and held my secrets, including dirty letters that I couldn't at the time translate from a German boy who'd been the object of a minor summer music camp romance." It's true.
I forgot about that part.
And I say this as a digression. The funny thing about that is I got these letters from this guy that I'd just known briefly in this light romantic way and couldn't translate them. My dad spoke German, and it's like I almost asked my dad to translate them, and something stopped me from doing that. So anyway, I was awkward and insecure, confused about how to find my place in life. Often I was lonely. All of this was true despite the fact that I was hurtling into my junior year of high school as captain of my varsity track team. I was younger than most of my classmates at Claremont High School, and my friends all had their driver's licenses by the start of our junior year. I was not, however, allowed to ride in their cars. The only time I ever got grounded in high school was when my librarian mother caught me sneaking a ride with a friend to get to my French class at the local college. I grew up in a college town, a faculty brat, where everyone knew my mom and dad. My parents, as I said, had made a critical decision early in the lives of my younger brother Mark and me that regardless of what career opportunities came my father's way, they would not move until we had graduated from high school. I grew up in one place where everyone knew me. I couldn't even get away with sneaking to my college courses. Which of us does not remember what life was like at 15? The torments of adolescence leave indelible marks. 8 years after I got grounded for sneaking to class in that friend's car, my 15-year-old cousin, Michael Alexander Allen, who also didn't yet have a driver's license, was arrested for the first time for an attempted carjacking. A few months later, after he turned 16, he sat in Torrance, California in court, the standard kind with swinging gates just inside the doors of the courtroom, handcuffed there and in an orange suit, as a judge determined that he would be charged as an adult. So again, just sort of think about being 15 and all the things that happen between 15 and 25, right? You're going to fall in love. You star for the first time. You're trying to figure out your own independence, your relationship to your family, and so forth. And all those rituals happen in prison, all the things kids go through, but in an environment that distorts those experiences profoundly and adds some, right, that aren't on our list. So
at all.
Various kinds of brutalization.
And the stakes are higher for mistakes.
Yeah.
The ages of 15 to 26 are the sort of the times when you're first sort of going out on your own and making your own value judgments about who people are, what their intents with you are.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike the lives that most of us live, I feel like the consequences of choosing poorly in prison are literally death can be one of the risks, but and he went and he had all those experiences, and Bree was the person who sustained him in many ways.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, that when he fell in love with Bree, I mean, that's when I said the thing about you listen to the person's voice when you're having these calls, and there was just incredible contentment in his voice, and that's what I heard, and that's what I held on to, and I was grateful for that in those calls, again, it's sort of this question of what is it that we do with and for young people when they get into trouble? And I just feel like that age, 10 to 14 in the first place, then sort of 15 and the years following, I think there's a lot more that we could do to help young kids when they get into trouble and to be a lot clearer about the degree of coordinated attention from adults that they need and the fact that they need protection in these dangerous environments, like from us, not from gangs or whatever else is sort of offering protection in the context of sort of dangerous street life.
So he doesn't take the apartment.
He doesn't take the apartment, no. And that really is the sort of turning point moment. Because, right. I mean, you guys are Angelenos. So you know where LA Valley Community College is. So since he didn't take the apartment, he decided to live with his mother in South Central. Okay, and he was working on the Sears that was, you know, Santa Monica and, not like, Santa Monica, sorry, what did I try to say?
So Melrose and Western?
Yeah, exactly.
Right by the 101?
It's not there anymore, exactly, that's yeah. right. But you guys get that, right? Like in traffic, the person who doesn't have a car and is trying to use buses to maintain that, I mean, we just all know from the get-go that that's not going to work. So sure enough, the school piece fell out pretty quickly. And then by late November, he got out in June. By late November, he got the job at the end of July. By late November, he got into a fight with some fellow workers at Sears. By his account, they called him a nigger. And they got into a fight, and he walked off the job and didn't tell his managers what happened. And so then he was sort of like starting from scratch, but like six steps back,
right?
Because now he, you know, hadn't held the job and all that. So, and then by the end of the year, so, you know, he and Bree reconnected, and sort of just a month or so shy of the anniversary of his release, he got into a fight with another one of Bree's lovers, and that sent him back to prison on a parole violation. And that second stint in prison broke him. So he was a different person when he came out the second time, in a way that he hadn't felt like a different person the first time he came out.
And can you specify that a little? Like, and you would think going through 11 years in prison from 15 to 26 would be the thing that would change a person. But for the most part, it seems like he was still very much the kid that you knew growing up. But the second stint, far shorter, once he's already in adulthood, seems to have changed him dramatically. And I'm curious how exactly.
Well, I mean, the first time he came out with hope.
Right.
And the second time he came out, there was no hope left. By then he knew there was no hope. That's all. And it was just the reality of the situation, that there was not, in a meaningful way, a chance to put the pieces of a life back together. And I say that, I mean, I know some people do make reentry work,
right.
But, you know, not very many, if
we're honest
about it. And
certainly far too few.
And I mean, I use this metaphor in a variety of different kinds of contexts. But I keep saying I was watching the Olympics last summer, and there was this gymnast from India named Deepa Karmakar. And I don't know if any of you guys watched the gymnastics coverage, but basically the thing about Deepa was that she was going to do a maneuver which is the highest degree of difficulty that gymnastics offers. And so, you know, the talking heads are like, "Well, is she going to pull it off, or is she going to break her back?" Is she going to pull it off, or is she going to break her back? That was the either-or choice. And, like, most gymnasts were, like, doing, like, slightly less difficult ones.
Right.
Like, you make it, or you fall on your butt, but you don't break your back sort of thing. And I sort of think of these issues as being like kids in inner cities in context of violence face that kind of degree of difficulty. Reentry is that kind of degree of difficulty. Yes. Some people can do it. Deepa did it. She pulled off the maneuver. She didn't break her back, okay? So it can, in fact, be done. It can be mastered. But for everybody who doesn't master it, they break their back. And that's where I feel like the issue of our responsibility as a society alongside individual responsibility really comes into focus. It's like we are the ones who are establishing the degree of difficulty that's presented to young people in cities, at the moment of reentry for people when they're trying to have a second chance. Like, we've got to take responsibility for the degree of difficulty that we're establishing for people.
One of the things that I'm struck by in the book is you know, these sort of three big pockets, right? Sort of Michael's individual responsibility, the family's
right.
responsibility, and then society, and really the carceral state's responsibility in sort of putting him in the situation that he was in. And I'm curious where you see the sort of points of connection between those three things.
Yeah.
And what, not what could have been done differently. I'm not a big fan of sort of running back the clock, but how should the individual responsibility, familial responsibility, and the state's responsibility be working in tandem, either through reentry or as these kids are coming up, that might work better?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot to say about this. And so for me, the way of kind of encapsulating the main things I want to say are that, like, the problem is family secrets. The problem is family secrets. So, When I was working on this book, I interviewed lots of family members, and I did a lot of research in sociology. And one of the bodies of scholarship I looked into was this question of how is it young kids get pulled into the worlds of gangs and so forth, and how does that work? And, you know, there's real consistency across the literature that kids start flirting with gangs in that sort of 10 to 13-year age range. And 18 months after they start flirting, they have their first arrest. Fits Michael to a T. And it's sort of exactly the pattern. And as I was interviewing family members, I realized, like, this person had that little piece of the story, and another person had this little piece of the story, but we'd never put the whole story together. And why not? Because we don't talk about these kinds of challenges, these troubles, because there's shame around this kind of part of the life of young people. So, like, you got to break through shame and get the conversations going so that there's enough knowledge to help, enough knowledge about what a young person is facing. But when I talk about family secrets, I'm not just talking about my family and our family secrets and the particular things that may have made us not good at talking. I think as a society, we have family secrets. And so that's also what I'm really trying to convey. So some of you have heard me ask this question before, but I do like to ask if who knows how much Americans spend out of pocket on illegal drugs every year? Anybody know?
I'm going to take a guess.
$100 billion. See, but you didn't know. Family secret. The fact that we don't know this and don't talk about it. Now, and if let's just like think through what the consequences of this family secret are for a minute. All right, so first of all, teenagers, adolescents already don't like to talk to their parents, okay? Now, like, let's just say some activity with drugs gets involved in what they're doing. That's illegal. Things have changed recently in California, I recognize, but that's very new, so we're still figuring out where that goes. That's going to make honesty, so forth, even harder, right? So a $100 billion illegal market is just a way in which a society builds hypocrisy and deception and lies into its very heart. And you can't build a healthy society when you've done that. So I've got a few more things to say about the war on drugs, if you don't mind. So let me just go ahead and share them all.
Because I'll let you share them all. If you have questions, though, we'll jump to that immediately after. So please, indict the American criminal system. I am with you.
The first thing to say is just to recognize the way in which the war on drugs turned into something else. So in the late 80s and early 1990s, when police were asked to estimate how many drug transactions they thought were involved gangs, they would put their estimates at 90%. And scholars have been able to go back and say actually the number was about 50%. But because of that perception, the war on drugs turned into a war on gangs. Now, gangs are problematic even apart from drugs, okay, so I'm not trying to suggest otherwise, but what this meant was that the way that the state, California in particular, but also the federal government, approached the issue of the narcotics trade was to target street-level distributors, okay? Now, if you stop and think about this for a moment, you can see a dynamic that emerges. Now, if you have a $100 billion business and somebody's trying to shut down your distributors, what are you going to do? Are you going to let that happen? No. You're going to fight back and build your own system of sanctions and penalties and rewards to try to control your distributors. And so you get the violence of the world of gangs as a counterpoint to the deterrent strategies of the state. So you get a fight between the state and what I call the parastate. All right? And who gets caught in that fight? The kids. In particular, the young kids, 10 to 14, okay, whom both sides are trying to recruit in some sense, all right? So you get increases of violence because of the decision to target this massive black market in this fashion. But so when we think about our criminal justice system, there are other important things to take on board about it. So I mentioned, okay, I was in England in graduate school studying ancient history, okay? I was saying punishment in ancient Athens, of all things. So I think about punishment in like a world historical context, like thousands of years across the whole globe. And so I can confirm for you that the world has never seen a penal system like the one we've built. Never. Okay, so just to remind ourselves, right, we've got 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's incarcerated people. I imagine that many of you knew that already. Okay, like this is a made in America special. It hasn't been done before. We have to own the fact that we built this. Now, often, you know, people are surprised because Michael didn't use drugs. He wasn't selling drugs when the time he went to prison at 15. He was at the very end of his life before he was killed. Okay, but people are like, well, why are you putting this story about him and juvenile justice together with the war on drugs and so forth? And the reason is the one I just described about the way in which the war on drugs has generated violence, okay, and exposed young people to violent circumstances. When they're exposed to violent circumstances, they need protection, all right? And then you get a pathway to temptation for participation in this universe. But I know I'm taking more time than I should.
Please, please continue.
I just want to have 6 more points. I don't know if it's that many exactly, but when people talk about mass incarceration and the question of how we can reduce the numbers of people in prison, and you'll say, well, let's let nonviolent offenders go, nonviolent drug offenders go from prison, okay? And people will counter say, well, that's only 14% of people who are incarcerated anyway. So we could get rid of nonviolent, you know, drug offenses and so forth, but that would only reduce things by 14%. And, you know, my answer to that is, well, you know, I'll take that 14%. I'm not going to complain about that. But we also have to stop and think about what else the war on drugs is doing to our penal system. So it's not just nonviolent drug offenses. It's the increase in violence that I just described, right? That's another set of offenses that are filling our prisons. But then beyond that, so in 2013, just to take a random year, 32% of filings in federal courts were for drug cases, okay? So what does that mean? That means prosecutors' workloads are swollen by drug cases. Now, when prosecutors' workloads are swollen by drug cases, it means they can't put as much attention and energy to other kinds of things, as in, for instance, homicides. So according to police, sort of anecdotally, it's harder to take a homicide case to a prosecutor unless it's an open and shut case that's going to get a plea deal. And so some people think that this is what explains the drop in homicide clearance rates in the country. So in the middle of the 20th century, for example, homicide clearance rates across the country were about 90%. Now, 60% is good. The LA area, you're probably hovering between 50 and 60%. Detroit, before its bankruptcy, had gotten down into the teens for homicide clearance rates. Now, this is really important because when you don't clear homicides, it's not just that you have a kind of environment where murder goes unpunished and you have revenge and so forth. Economists have shown that what you actually get is a phase shift, because if you're in a world where you know somebody can harm you without any penalty, what's the solution? The best defense is a strong offense. And so everybody sort of shifts up in terms of the level of violence. And so, and there, people have documented this, not so much in this country, but in other countries, but that's part of what's happening. So there's a phase shift in the level of violence, okay? So that gives you another chunk of the people who are in prison, right? It's coming out of that activity. But then, further point. So when you think about the penalties that we've had for simple possession, I'm not sure exactly where they are in California, but in other states, it could be up to a year for marijuana possession. I know California has gotten rid of that now, so that, again, like, that's a huge change in California. But for crack and cocaine, from 1 year to 5 years in prison, okay, for simple possession. So then, to keep your penal system making any sense, everything else has to shift much longer. Right? So the criminalizing simple use and possession skews the whole penal system. And it's like, that's another reason there are more people in prison, because people have longer sentences, okay? And then we could throw in the mandatory minimums as a part of the story as well. The point is simply that the criminalization of marijuana, other drugs, and so forth has given us a criminal justice system that is skewed on so many different dimensions that they're all contributing to the numbers of people who are in prison. So for that reason, it will come as a surprise to you, but at the end of the book, personal memoir though it is, I make an argument for legalizing marijuana and decriminalizing cocaine and heroin. Now, that's an important distinction. Decriminalizing means switching from a felony to a misdemeanor, okay? And then taking resources that have been used to target lower-level activity and targeting higher-level traffickers. And it means switching from a criminal justice paradigm to a public health paradigm for thinking about the problems of addiction and drug use. And there's a lot more that can be said about this. Portugal has tried it. They have lower adolescent drug use in the wake of it. They have more people seeking treatment, and they actually are capturing more contraband from high-level traffickers than when they had a system that was closer to ours. So, as I said, and that's, you know, a lot of specific stuff. But
it was great.
Yeah.
Do you guys have questions? I feel like I've monopolized our time quite enough. Anybody?
Thank you for listening, everybody.
All right, we're going to go over here.
My name is Donald, and I heard you say that something about being imprisoned, it didn't change maybe in his first stint, his frame of reference, his frame of mind. And it does. I've been imprisoned. It does. It changes how and what you prioritize, and those desires to be free, you know, really become more just desires, that inward freedom. That's what you have to seek out. So in not saying that my experience is the overall experience, in looking at what our young people are going through, that imprisonment, when your parents have no jobs, when your parents haven't gone to college or seen a broader horizon in the Black community, because that's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about my people.
Yeah.
So that imprisonment starts at 6, 5, 4, 3 years old. So when you get to a point where you think you can reach out and that first boot really does hit you, there is a loss of hope. There, you know, because there's never been a building of hope.
Right.
That hope has to be something that you yourself have. And that first boot does so often not just dent the car, not just kicks the wheel off, but jams or damages the engine.
Yeah.
That's where we have to begin to find a way.
Donald, can I ask you a question?
Well, I heard a question there, which was about a little bit about my, when I said that Michael hadn't changed when he got out. And I don't want, that wasn't what I meant to convey. So let me try to restate my answer to that question, which is to say, yes, I mean, there was a quietness in Michael underneath the joy and the brightness that were what he presented to the world and shared with everybody. But the gentle Michael, the Michael who had plans for the future, had a sense of hope, and had that internally, that was there. That Michael was the Michael we knew when he went to prison, and we had that Michael when he got out. When Michael got out the second time, those features of him were not there. So the change had gone further, all right? So yes, he was certainly changed in lots of ways when he got out the first time. Would never say otherwise. But he had managed to preserve some of the best and most beloved features of himself and his character despite the hardships of prison. And the second stint in, I would not say that of.
Any questions?
Thank you for really highlighting and talks about the secrets that we have as family, right, as a nation. Drugs, it's a huge problem. And, you know, you said you, in the end of your book, you discuss ways that as a society we can shift from decriminalizing drugs. In terms of, like, prison, because I understand that you said it was, what, 30% of, I think, minorities or specific Black people are in prison, compared to what's in Los Angeles. Like, I think it's 5%. I think I was reading an article about it. What do you think we should do as a society to make that shift into, I guess, a change of consciousness in terms of how we should act?
So, I mean, there's a lot to say there. People often tell a story about American criminal justice where the story is, we had a rehabilitative system. We focused on trying to give people resources in prison that would help them have a second chance. And we stripped that all out and turned it into a retributive system, a sort of angry, sort of vindictive system. And I actually say something a little contradictory there. I don't think we did actually turn it into a retributive system. What we did was turn it into a deterrent system. And, deterrence is about, shut it down. Shut it down. Like, anything it takes to shut it down. We're shutting it down. It's carjacking. It's whatever other crimes, et cetera. It's a long list of things. And so the target of deterrence is kind of like aggregate numbers of crimes, not the specific case of a given wrongdoer and a given victim. And retribution, however, is about fitting the punishment to the crime. It actually requires proportionality. And I actually think our system lost proportionality. Like, I actually wish our system were retributive, okay? Because it's not, all right? And that's where, and you can go beyond that. I mean, you don't have to start, I do think we need to rebuild rehabilitative elements of our penal system. And then there are also important innovations in what's called restorative justice, which is about finding alternatives to imprisonment that permit people to reconcile the wrong they've done, find other ways of making good the wrong they've done, and heal the community generally. There's a lot of progress that's been made on this in Australia, and it's making inroads in this country as well. So I do think that there are other models, but just plain getting that concept of proportionality and permitting judges, for example, to make judgments about the circumstances of wrongdoers. The judges, like, one of the strange things about writing this book, it's like the different categories of thing that people come up to me and say, I can't say this out loud, but. I can't say this in public, but. All right? So, for example, the first time I presented this material, sort of set of lectures at Harvard, I was astounded by the number of people who came up to me and said, I've never told anybody, but I have a family member in prison. All right? It's like that was one of those categories. I'm like, well, let's all tell our stories, because maybe if we all told our stories, we would have the basis for a major change. But the second category is judges. Judges who come up to me and say, I can't say this out loud, but dealing with mandatory minimums has made me feel like I'm enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act or something like that. Like, that's literally the analogy they use. It's been astonishing to me how many judges have said that. So, like, our judges don't believe in the justice of our criminal justice system. Precisely because it's lost proportionality, they can't actually fit their judgments to the circumstances of the case.
We have time for one more? Two more, and then I have one to close on.
Thank you so much for bringing this to everybody's attention. I had a nephew who was held for 9 months. He had 3 cases in 3 counties. He originally had been a presidential scholar at a major university and had headed up a state senator's office, but due to mental health, he got involved in some things that got him into trouble. They weren't major, but he was held for 9 months, and fortunately, we pulled our family resources to get a lawyer with psychologist training that would not charge us a whole lot of money. If we had not had that as a resource, my nephew would probably still be there today. Fortunately, he had a year of parole. He was stayed with a family member for a year, and he got mental health help, and he is now working for a university, and he was fortunate in that way. Not everybody has those resources. I just want to say a couple more things. We can learn from Germany. I saw a report that said that they have very few people in prison there because they have diversion programs. So I'm sorry. So I just wanted to say, any ideas that you have to prevent this continuation of Jim Crow I think it's all about the money. They built all those prisons in the 80s. I worked for an architecture firm that did that, and then they had to fill them. They shipped all the jobs overseas. They put drugs in the community. And now the schools are on lockdown, you know. So that's all I have to say.
So thank you for sharing your story. I mean, I honestly, I was, Many of us were very upset last November on election night, but I was happy because California had legalized marijuana,
right,
and Massachusetts. And I actually think that is the beginning of the change. That's not the only thing we need to do, and we need to do it nationally. I work on developing and supporting diversion programs precisely so that we can take the issue of drug use and drug addiction and see it and respond to it as a health issue, individual health and well-being and public health. And I think those are burgeoning programs. Seattle has some great models. It's called the LEAD program. It's sort of spreading to the degree it's possible to support those programs. It's really important to do so. The reason it's important is because, it's just to the point that you said, the war on drugs has massively expanded the budgets for the judicial branches of government. Okay? Nobody wants their budget to shrink.
Right.
And so if we want to actually move the lever and switch from thinking about drugs as a criminal justice issue to a health issue, you've got to actually like get in there in small places where people aren't totally recognized that the lever is moving. And diversion programs do that. So when you can divert pre-arrest to social services to help people with their drug issue, or even between arrest and prosecution so that people don't get a felony on their record and so forth. And I mean, that it means resources do start to direct towards social services and health services rather than the justice system. You know, that you need to tip the whole thing that way.
Last question.
Thank you for sharing your cousin's story. My question is more of a personal nature, and I don't think anybody else is going to ask this, but it is important that it to me that it gets out. I have met people in Trump's America, though this is not his America, and other administrations, and as we talked about, this goes all the way back to slavery. I've met people who will, regardless of whatever you say in your book, believe that your cousin was going to go on this path and it was inevitable because mm-hmm. they don't see the humanity in him.
Right.
And you telling his story and all of these wonderful details shows that he is just like those people and he could be their son,
yeah.
even if he's not the same color as them.
Right.
So do you think that maybe telling this story will get through to those people? Because just in my humble estimation, that's the only way you're really going to move the needle, if people see him as human and not a number.
That was beautifully said.
Yep.
Thank you. So I do believe, so Michael loved to write, and he was talented. You heard that a little bit, and I didn't read more of his essay. I just read a little bit of the Tiny Chaucer part. But anyway, read.
Buy the book.
Yeah.
It's worth it.
Because there's an essay, his essay about Dante's Inferno is at the center of the book. And there were many things that hurt about losing Michael when he died in 2009. But one of them was simply that we always thought he would tell his own story. And so we had to find a way to let his story come out. And I do hope that other people will do the same thing, because I do believe that if we could get these stories out, the humanity, the talent, the potential that we're just destroying year after year would become visible to people. And I don't see how, in the face of that, looking honestly, we can continue.
So I had a final question, but we're not going to end better than that. Danielle, thank you. It has been a profound honor.
Oh, thank you, Franklin. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I want to say two other things. The first is a reminder that Aloud is free because of the support of people like you. There's an opportunity to donate in the lobby. And if you can't donate in the lobby, go to, I believe it's lapl.org/aloud. Do I have that right? LFLA. Thank you. /aloud. You can donate there as well. The second thing is buy the book. Maybe have Kleenex with you while you read it. I know I needed that. But it's truly extraordinary. There's an opportunity to do it in the lobby. Danielle, thanks again. Thank you all so much.
Thank you
for coming. Everybody have a great night.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.